to Princeton, where he did his PhD with Tom Duffy. He received his PhD in 2001, after which he was awarded a Miller Postdoctoral Fellowship from UC Berkeley, and he was there from 2001 until 2003. Since then, he's been at his current position at MIT as an assistant professor. Dan's doing a lot of groundbreaking experimental work on deep earth materials, and I believe today we're going to hear about the new, latest, and greatest phase transition in the deep earth. So please join me in welcoming Dan Chen.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's very exciting to have very different audience today. I normally talk to folks in the geology or geophysics department, and I try my best to introduce some of the exciting things happening in my field today as much as possible. I've been here once, 6-7 years ago, as a tourist. One thing I remember, two things I remember. One is CN Tower, and the second thing is the hotel I'm staying this time. It happens to be the, I realized a couple of days ago that I'm going to stay at the same hotel I stayed 6 years ago. But anyway, as a geophysicist, especially as a geophysicist who is interested in deep earth interior, looking down from the CN Tower through glass floor, you know, reminds me pretty much about our dream of looking down deep inside the earth with naked eye and talk about the great processes and very intriguing things about Earth interior, then, you know, you realize that you're not going to get a job if you would have seen the Earth interior with naked eye. Well, certainly, over the years, we geophysicists have developed many different methods to understand the processes inside of the Earth, and seismologists have used earthquakes to understand the structure of the Earth interior, and geochemists and petrologists have used rocks and materials from deep inside of the Earth try to understand chemical processes, and we experimentalists use devices. Here I show one example, which is diamond cell. I don't know whether you heard about this device or not, which generates extreme high pressure in the lab conditions that allows us to study behaviors and changes in material properties at extreme high pressure. So why we study Earth interior? Well, first, it's interesting. And second, you know, Earth interior is not completely, you know, separate from, you know, the surface where we live in. And this shows the seafloor topography, and you can recognize a couple of very remarkable features if you look at the seafloor topography. Obviously, in this picture, anything on the continent is not interesting, so it blacks out. But but if you look at the structures here, one of the remarkable things you can see is the extension of, you know, linear structure here in the mid-Atlantic Ocean, where, you know, crust breaks up and the new material forms. And if you look at the circumpacific area, you can see the region where the cold materials near the surface subduct into the deep earth interior. And also the remarkable feature at the center of the Pacific you can find is this, you know, kinked linear chain of seamounts, where, you know, it's very difficult to explain without having a deep magma source, which is almost insensitive to the plate motion at the surface of the Earth. So these structures document that there must be some sort of exchange, material exchange, or processes that exchange materials between the surface and the deep Earth interior. There are many different layers in the Earth. Seismologists like to make more layers in the Earth interior. Well, their main tool is to measure the seismic wave velocities and the density as a function of depth. And you can see a couple of the this continuous increase in density and sound elastic wave velocities, namely one at 400 kilometers here, 700 kilometers, you have large drop in P wave velocity at about 3,000 kilometer from the surface, you have almost none below 3,000 kilometers for shear wave velocity, and you have a very steep increase in density. This layer represents the interface between metallic iron core and silicate mantle, and this huge contrast in chemistry and physical state. By the way, the outer core is in liquid state and the mantle is in solid state. So this interface existing at 3,000 kilometer represents huge contrast in chemical composition and physical state. And because of this contrast, this layer has inspired many geophysicists for a long time over the years. And this cartoon shows some of the popular model out there where subducting slab reaches the bottom of the mantle. And some of the people believe that the intraplate volcano has a source in deep earth interior, which is perhaps, you know, core mantle boundary. Throughout this talk, I'm going to use a jargon here, so-called D double prime, to infer the 200 to 300 kilometer layer existing at the bottom of the mantle. So, in other words, mantle side of the core mantle boundary. Indeed, seismologists have seen very intriguing changes at the core mantle boundary. This slide shows four different tomographic images of the Earth interior. First row shows the tomographic images at mid-mantle, and the second row shows the tomographic images obtained at the bottom of the mantle, and the left side column shows compressional wave tomography, and the right-hand side shows shear wave tomography. And one thing you can easily something I have to give you first is that the blue represents the area where wave propagation is faster than average, and the red represents the area where wave propagation is slower than average. Something you can easily recognize is that you have a lot more lateral variation in elastic wave velocity at the core mantle boundary compared with the mid-mantle, and the magnitude of change is a lot greater at the bottom of the mantle compared to the mid-mantle. So this tells us something going on at the bottom of the mantle. Yet there are many different parameters that can change the wave propagation or wave speed, namely temperature, composition, and the phase. Question is, how much temperature difference or heterogeneity can be sustained for geological timescale, which is millions of years? As I said in the beginning of this talk, there are some regions where we have an evidence that cold surface material or near surface material being subducted into the deep earth interior. For those areas, people have studied the tomography, and they found extension of blue material or, you know, fast velocity anomalies extended from the surface to the very bottom of the mantle. For example, in the area where you have cross-section like here. And not only this region, but also other regions, you can see extension of cold materials coming from the surface to the bottom of the mantle or mid-mantle. And this certainly tells you that this structure may be originated from the temperature difference, because we know that the material being subducted into the deep mantle has nearly similar chemical composition as other part of the mantle, except for the very top portion of the plate. So this tells us that there exists some degree of temperature heterogeneity in Earth's interior. Some model proposed that the temperature gradient, or easier way to say is that the temperature difference between blue structure and red structure in the tomography can be as large as 500 Kelvin or more at the Kohlmanner boundary. But what is most important thing to remember is that there are lines of evidence that the temperature heterogeneity can be sustained for sufficiently long time in the Earth mantle. Chemical composition. Mantle rocks are composed mainly of magnesium, silicon, and oxygen. So magnesium silicates. And you have small amount of calcium and iron, as well as aluminum. But, you know, if you look at the rocks on the surface, you see a great deal of changes in chemical composition. And it's not unreasonable to assume that we would have some degree of chemical composition change in deep mantle. The third parameter that I would like to discuss is the phase change. If you think about a very simple system where you have anion and cation, and let's think about the case where you need to compress this system. A very easy way to do it is to bring them together. In other words, decrease the distance between cation and anion, right? If you squeeze material, one thing you would imagine is that the atomic distance, interatomic distance, would decrease as a function of compression. But you soon realize that you cannot compress these, you know, opposite charged particles that much, because as you bring them together and pass the so-called equilibrium distance, you start to see huge increase in energy because of the repulsion between the electrons in cation and electrons in anion. So it's not an efficient way to accommodate the stress for solid. The other way to do it is to change the structure such that they can still maintain equilibrium distance, yet by changing, for example, coordinations and packing densities, they can accommodate external stress without sacrificing interatomic distance. Indeed, there are lines of evidence in the Earth interior that the mantle minerals undergoes series of phase transformation. In early 1920s and 30s, seismologists have already recognized that there exist a couple of discontinuous changes in seismic wave velocities and densities at around 400 kilometers and 660 kilometers. The question is, what causes this discontinuous increase? In fact, mineral physicists or experimentalists were already had an evidence in their pocket, but they didn't realize that it would exist in the mantle. But in early 1920s, people have already have shown experimentally that mantle minerals might undergo series of phase transformation at similar pressures as you find in this discontinuities. So this slide shows series of phase transformation from olivine to modified spinel. Those who know something about condensed matter physics or material science, study material science, these are pretty common structure in condensed matter physics. And spinel structure, and then ultimately transforms to perovskite structure. Here I describe three important parameters to think about for understanding the seismic tomography, and ultimately we want to tie our understanding to the mantle dynamics ultimately. One of the most enigmatic yet very exciting region in the Earth interior has been the interface between core and the mantle. And there has been many exciting observations in seismology, but we haven't had good explanation on those structures and observations. Today, I'm going to introduce some of those observations. And then in 2004, we experimentalists did some new measurements at very high pressure temperature conditions directly relevant to the Kolmogorov boundary, we realized that the lower mantle mineral, which has a perovskite structure, surprisingly transforms to some new structure. The reason it was very surprising is that, again, those who heard about perovskite structure known to be very flexible. So it is somewhat makes sense for geophysicists why this perovskite structured mineral is stable for very large range of pressure from 25 GPa to all the way down to 125 GPa. I'm going to spend a little time on introducing our experimental technique here. This is a photograph we took through the diamond for the sample, which is so-called post-perovskite. I mean, it's a little unfortunate name. We don't know how to name it, so we decided to saying that something after perovskite, surrounded by argon pressure medium. To give you an idea about the device we use natural gem quality diamonds, diamond crystals. These are single crystals. It's just regular stones you will find in any gem stores. It's a diamond shape. And we cut the tip and make a flat surface on the tip of the diamond. And then we face them each other and we squeeze materials between those so-called cullets. And by doing it, you know that the diamond is one of the most, you know, one of the strongest material known in the nature. So it sustains, you know, large amount of stress, which is good for us to squeeze materials. And then here, in the laterally, what you see is the gasket material to prevent the sample blow out of the your device. So this photo was taken through one of the diamond anvil, and this also shows the beauty of using diamond anvil because it's transparent. So you can see your sample directly through your pressure anvil under high pressure. And also, diamond allows us to bring in X-ray beams, laser beams, through the diamond crystal and measure physical properties of these materials under extreme high pressure conditions. So something I need to point out before going to this slide is that the sample we are dealing with is extremely small. You can see the scale bar at the top left corner. The sample we are dealing with at 135 GPa is about 10 microns in diameter, and thickness is about 1 micron. So you have extremely small amount of material. If you were to measure the weight of or mass of this small sample, it is in the picogram range. So you're dealing with extreme small sample. So to be able to measure something out of this sample, you need extremely bright source. For example, if you want to do X-ray diffraction experiment, your X-ray source needs to be extremely bright, and the only source that allows us to do experiment under megabar conditions or hundreds of GPa is third generation synchrotron facility. This area of photo shows one facility at Argonne National Lab in the United States. This schematic diagram shows how we do experiments. So this represents two diamond anvils. We squeeze sample between them. And the gray stuff here is the gasket material. The red stuff at the center is our sample. We bring in X-ray beam from the synchrotron synchrotron ring. And then we illuminate the sample with X-ray and get the diffraction pattern to get crystallographic information. If you want to do spectroscopy, you can arrange the detector setup a little differently. And also, in order to achieve high temperature of the mantle, which ranges between 2,000 Kelvin to all the way up to 5,000 Kelvin, we focus infrared laser beam on the surface of the sample to increase the temperature to such high temperature. The first question, I'm going back to post-perovskite transition. About this post-perovskite transition is that, okay, it's exciting to see new phase transformation in Earth-related material. Next question is whether this new phase transformation discovered in the lab is really relevant to the Earth. And you want to have some evidence that this phase transformation do exist in the mantle. Last 20, 30 years, in seismology, it's been known that there exists some discontinuous stepwise increase in S wave velocity, shear wave velocity, and compressional wave velocity, at about 200 to 400 kilometers above the Kolmenov boundary. Okay, so that may be a candidate. So in the lab, we measure the pressure, temperature conditions where this lower mantle perovskite phase transforms to so-called post-perovskite phase, which is recently discovered. And this shows the two different experimental results. They actually, you can see some discrepancy between them, but you know, the uncertainty in pressure we measure is about 10 gigapascal range. So the gray area here shows pressure temperature conditions corresponding to the D double prime discontinuity. The name of the discontinuity I show in previous slide is the D double prime discontinuity. And it's roughly in the ballpark. And that leads to the conclusion that this phase transformation may indeed exist in the Earth's interior and may exist 200 to 400 kilometers above the Kolmenov boundary. The fundamental information we need in order to understand the physical property of this new phase is the crystal structure. Going back to lower mantle, from 600 kilometers to all the way down to 3,000 kilometers from the surface, it's been known for many years is that silicates crystallize into so-called perovskite structure, which has two cation sites. One is 12 coordinated and the other is 6-fold coordinated. And silicon occupies the 6-fold coordinated sites. And it's known that the silicon-oxygen bonding is really strong. So silicon-oxygen behaves like a one rigid unit in the perovskite structure. And if you look at the perovskite structure, it is three-dimensional network structure. And silicon-oxygen octahedra are linked by sharing the oxygen at the corner. And if you look at the post-perovskite phase predicted by first principles, it is very difficult to get single crystal of post-perovskite because of the extreme pressure, temperature stability conditions of this phase. So at the moment, we don't have any single crystal results. But first principles or quantum mechanical calculation can predict possible structures. And one of the most, you know, one of the structure that is, you know, well received by the community is this layered two-dimensional structure. You still have silicon coordinated by six oxygens, so six-fold coordinated, and you have magnesium intercalated between octahedral layers. And one of the biggest difference between these two structure is the existence of edge sharing in post-perovskite, whereas in perovskite, all the linkage between the octahedra are by corner sharing. In the later part of my talk, I will briefly discuss about what kind of consequences you would get by having this difference in the structure. So we did some experiment, try to get good powder diffraction pattern. And once you have good powder diffraction pattern, the next thing you can do is to do linear, least square fitting of your data to theoretically predicted structures. See if we can reproduce atomic positions proposed by first principles calculation. So we have, you know, number of hundreds of iterations of calculations until we match the observed X-ray diffraction pattern by varying the atomic parameters. And we've measured the X-ray diffraction pattern of this new post-perovskite phase from, you know, pressure-temperature conditions corresponding to the Kolmenov boundary to down to very low pressure. This slide shows a couple of important atomic parameters to compare. here, you probably only want to focus on the data points within the stability field of Buss-Perovskite, which is between 115 GPA and 140 GPA. These dots represents our data points for different structural parameters, and the horizontal gray bars represents first principles prediction or predictions from quantum mechanics. You can see beautiful agreement between experiment and the theory, and this shows that the it is likely that the Buss-Perovskite phase has a two-dimensional structure with edge sharing. One of the most important dynamic important parameter in geodynamics is related to the phase transformation is so-called Clapeyron slope. What it means is that the PT slope in the PT phase diagram. And just to give you an idea, I also have a little table which shows the Clapeyron slope of other phase transformations found in the mantle so far. They exist between 400 kilometers and 700 kilometers in the mantle, shallower depth, and this is the Clapeyron slope for Buss-Perovskite. And one thing you can recognize is that two things. First, it has a positive sign. We'll discuss about the positive sign later part of my talk. And more importantly, the magnitude of the slope. If you compare the slope with other phase transformations, it's probably the largest slope ever reported for the Mantle transitions. So what kind of consequences we would have if you have large Clapeyron slope for the Earth interior? I talked briefly about relationship between D double prime discontinuity and the Buss-Perovskite transition, and saying that likely that D double prime discontinuity is caused by Buss-Perovskite transition. And in 1999, seismologists have studied the global change in D double prime discontinuity from the Coromandel boundary. So this is some sort of topography of D double prime discontinuity, and geographical, you know, topography of the D double prime discontinuity. And this color scale shows all the way down to 60 kilometers above the Coromandel boundary, all the way up to 300 kilometers above the Coromandel boundary. So you have fluctuation of this D double prime discontinuity by as much as like 250 kilometers, which is rather unusual for phase transformations we know, because the phase transformations existing at the shallow mantle, they often show some sort of topography, but it never exceed 10 to 20 kilometers. So this is about order of magnitude larger, and because of that, in 1999, when we didn't know that there exists a phase transformation, it was very difficult to relate this observation to the phase transformation. But if you look at this cartoon diagram, this Buss-Perovskite transition and especially large Clapeyron slope provides nice explanation. This is the temperature depth scale. Well, you can think of pressure instead of depth. Obviously, pressure doesn't increase linearly with depth, but it's almost like linear. And you have Coromandel boundary here, and this is a Buss-Perovskite boundary. Okay, and you can think of three different thermal profile at the bottom of the mantle. The blue represents colder area, and red represents the warmer area or hot area. And this cartoon shows the response of the Buss-Perovskite transition boundary with respect to this temperature change. For the colder region, you know, as shown by this blue curve, you would have Buss-Perovskite transition at the shallower depth. But for the average mantle, which is shown by yellow, because of the high temperature and large Clapeyron slope, your Buss-Perovskite transition occurs at the deeper depth. And for pretty hot area shown here, it is possible that this geotherm never even intersect with Buss-Perovskite transition, meaning that perovskite becomes still stable all the way down to the Coromandel boundary interface. So this nicely explains the large topography observed in the seismology. Right after discovery of the Buss-Perovskite transition, there has been a couple of interesting predictions about the possible seismic structures we would see. One of the interesting prediction has been so-called double crossing, which is shown in this cartoon diagram. It's again due to the large cooperative slope of the post-perovskite transition. And the other thing I missed in my talk is that the comminutal boundary, there exists thermal boundary layer, meaning that temperature all of a sudden approaching the comminutal boundary steeply increase and almost increase exponentially because, you know, because of the cooling of the core and all that stuff. So because of the nonlinear shape of the geotherm together with large Clapeyron slope, you would expect to have intersection of geotherm and post-perovskite transition not only once, but also twice, like this. So what happens if you would have this situation is that you have perovskite to post-perovskite transition at shallow depth, and then near the comminutal boundary, you have post-perovskite to perovskite phase transformation. So it's reverse transformation. So this would end up resulting in very peculiar structure, lens-shaped post-perovskite structure captured in perovskite mantle. Well, obviously, seismologists, after seeing this prediction, they like to find the evidence of existence of this structure. And there are many important geodynamic implications of this structure. For example, by having evidence of this structure, you can actually measure the temperature at the shallow transition. And also, you can measure temperature at the deeper transition, and that allows us to infer the temperature increase at the bottom of the mantle, which is very important parameter to constrain what's happening in the outer core. So it's very exciting to look for this structure. Indeed, there are a couple of exciting reports last year that seismologists claimed that they saw this structure. This image shows the interface seismologists have detected at the comminutal boundary. So this is a comminutal boundary, and this is elevation from the comminutal boundary. And you can see as large as 2,000 kilometer lateral extension of blue interface here, shown by dotted line. And then if you look carefully, you see a second line or interface, which is shown by red here. Well, I'm not a seismologist, so it's up to you whether this is reliable or not. But I'm one of the co-authors, so I think I believe this. But anyway, if you look hard, it resembles the structure that we predict by looking at the simple phase diagram, so which is pretty remarkable. Other intriguing thing is that there seems to be other interfaces that we don't explain very well yet, but it seems that it captures the first-order features in seismic observations, which is exciting and nice. But is there any problem of having positive large magnitude Clapeyron slope at the bottom of the mantle? I'm going back to 30 years ago when they first discovered the shallow mantle transitions, not the post-perovskite transition. Some people actually predicted that the mantle transition existing below 600 kilometers should have negative Clapeyron slope, which is opposite to our new discovery of post-perovskite transition, which is a little odd. And if you look at these predictions, there is pretty good argument about why the deep mantle transition should have negative Clapeyron slope. From simple thermodynamics, you can easily derive this Clausius-Clapeyron relations, and the Clapeyron slope is expressed as a function of entropy change across the phase transformation, and the volume change across the phase transformation. Obviously, for high pressure transformation, delta V should be minus because volume should decrease or density should increase. Well, it's up to entropy whether it should increase or decrease. It depends on the sign of this term that would ultimately determine the Clapeyron slope sign. So the argument there was that for the phase transformation existing at 660 kilometers, people have found that silicon is coordinated by more oxygens when it undergoes phase transformation, namely from 4 to 6. So what happens in this transformation is that all of a sudden, small silicon is occupied by more oxygens which allows more space for silicon. So all of a sudden, silicon fills more space to vibrate at high temperature. So that leads to the entropy increase, okay? So that will lead to the positive sign of entropy here, entropy term here, that leads to the minus Clapeyron slope. So it makes sense. But then what happens for the Pusperovskite transition where we saw positive Clapeyron slope? If you look at the these two structures, perovskite and Pusperovskite, and compare the structure, there exists no coordination number increase in silicon or even for magnesium. So the earlier prediction may not work for this case. More important structural feature you see is the change from corner sharing to edge sharing here. What happens if you have edge sharing compared to corner sharing is simple-minded thought. Your oxygen vibration would be much more restricted than it is in the perovskite. So that leads to the decrease in entropy. So that ends up making entropy term, you know, delta entropy term minus. So that leads to the positive sign. So it explains the Clapeyron slope. Okay. So what else we can explain? There are several proposals out there that potentially provides explanation for intriguing seismic observations. Today, I want to, in the rest of part of my talk, I want to focus on a couple of features. At the D double prime region, seismologists have long seen a feature, this continuous increase in seismic wave velocity above 200 to 400 kilometer above the covenant boundary. As I said in the earlier slide, what is interesting about this observation is that unlike other mantle transitions, P wave increase is much smaller than S wave increase. To give you an idea, for shallow mantle transitions, you normally have similar magnitude of change in P and S wave velocity. So it's something very different from what we have seen at shallow mantle. So how can we explain this with, let's say, Pusperovskite transition? The other interesting observation is so-called anti-correlation. This shows six different tomographic images. Three of them are shear wave velocity tomography, and three of them are so-called bulk sound velocity, which can be computed from P and S wave velocity. Nice thing about this bulk sound velocity is that it's insensitive to the dispersion effect. But anyway, more important thing is that, okay, each row shows the pair of tomographic images measured at different depth. And at shallow depth, if you trace the geographical location of red spots and blue spots, by the way, blue represents faster, red represents slower, they match pretty well, although there exists some difference. But, you know, when you have low bulk sound velocity, at a similar location, you have low shear wave velocity, which is reasonable if you have thermal anomaly. So if you would have high temperature region here, low temperature region surrounding the high temperature region, you would expect to have both velocities going down. Okay? And in the mid mantle, that trend still persists, more or less. But if you go to the bottom of the mantle, one thing that is very intriguing is that it seems that they show exact opposite color. And the location where you have low shear wave velocity, you have high bulk sound velocity, which is a little bit odd if you try to explain it with temperature variation. So the question is whether, you know, Pusperovskite transition may provide any explanation on this. Shear wave velocity is extremely difficult to measure in the lab in current technique, but from first principles calculations, we know that shear wave velocity should increase across the Pusperovskite transition. One thing that we can measure much more reliably is the bulk sound velocity. By measuring compressibility of the solid and the density of the solid, you can compute the bulk sound velocity. And indeed, theory predicts that the bulk sound velocity should decrease rather than increase across the Pusperovskite transition. Unfortunately, existing experiments shows complete opposite results, one proposing that, yes, it should decrease, but the other shows, no, it should increase by a lot. So which one is correct? So it is very difficult to measure compressibility in such high pressure because, you know, it's very high pressure, and diamond cell is by nature uniaxial device, so you would expect to have some sort of deviatoric stress in the device. And the problem is to minimize the deviatoric stress, otherwise you would have contamination from the deviatoric stress. So we do quasi-hydrostatic experiment. We load pressure medium, unlike other people, and we measure compressibility of this phase, and we find that bulk sound speed in this should decrease by 2.4%, which is consistent with theoretical prediction. One thing odd about this observation is that if you, again, go back to shallow mantle transitions, one thing you recognize, this is bulk sound speed at shallow depth for different phase transformations, they all increase by about 6%. So what we find in Pust-Perovskaya, it seems to be complete opposite to what we have known for shallow mantle transitions. Well, then, is there any problem in our experiment or theoretical predictions? We also have found that the Pust-Perovskaya transition exists in other materials, such as germanate fluoride and calcium iridium oxide. And we measure the bulk sound speed of perovskite phase, and which is blue, and Pust-Perovskaya phase, which is orange. We find that near the Pust-Perovskaya transition, which is shown by the box, the bulk sound speed of Pust-Perovskaya is always stay lower than that of perovskite, which leads to the conclusion that this rather unusual bulk sound speed decrease is basically controlled by structure rather than chemical composition. So we believe it's fairly robust feature. And going back to this tomographic image, so I explained that the Pust-Perovskaya compared to perovskite has lower bulk sound velocity and the higher shear velocity. So one way to explain it is to have perovskite at the middle of Pacific Ocean, not on the surface, at the Kolmenar boundary, surrounded by Pust-Perovskaya structure. Okay, and what else we can explain? Going back to this small P wave increase at the D double prime discontinuity, again, P wave velocity can be computed from the bulk sound velocity and S wave velocity. So if you would have increase in this parameter, but decrease in this parameter, then that compensate each other and ended up having almost none increase in P wave velocity. That nicely explained the smaller P wave increase. So it explains a couple of interesting features. But then, can we explain everything with Pust-Perovskaya? Do we need anything else? Temperature or composition? Indeed, well, one thing you have to realize is that Pust-Perovskaya is pressure-driven phase transformation. So lateral change in pressure is very small in the mantle, but I'm talking about lateral change. So how come pressure-driven transformation can have lateral changes? Well, if you look at this simple diagram, again, it's going back to large Clapeyron slope. Because of the large Clapeyron slope, the Pust-Perovskaya transition depth is extremely sensitive to the temperature anomalies. So, you know, if you would have colder region, you would have thick Pust-Perovskaya. If you have very hot region, you would have no Pust-Perovskaya. Going back, some suggest that chemical composition also has strong influence on the Pust-Perovskaya depth. For example, some suggest that iron pushes the Pust-Perovskaya boundary to shallower depth. So for the area where you don't have Pust-Perovskaya transition in cold region, I'm sorry, for the hot area where you wouldn't have Pust-Perovskaya transition otherwise, if you would have iron enrichment because this boundary moves up, you all of a sudden have an intersection. So you would have Pust-Perovskaya structure captured in perovskite. So from this, there, you can bring up two hypotheses. One is that the warm perovskite surrounded by cold Pust-Perovskaya. So you need both mineral change as well as temperature change, Or the other way around is that to be able to have mineral phase change, you need to have thermal change or thermal heterogeneity. And the other possibility is change in ion content. For example, you can interpret this tomography by saying that you have iron deficient perovskite at the middle of the Central Pacific and surrounded by iron rich post perovskite. Which one is correct is, you know, still in question. And there are one of these two models may not really match well with conventional wisdom of the mantle dynamics or so forth. But I don't want to go into the detail. Because I have physics audience, I decided to have a little bit of, you know, physics-related topic here at the end of my talk. One thing I want to talk about is the solid state at high pressure. In many compounds, high-pressure physicists have found the stability field of perovskite, which is somewhat reasonable for us because perovskite is such a flexible structure that a lot of compounds crystallize into this structure, and it has very high probability of surviving at extreme compressional state. But it's very exciting and somewhat unusual to see this phase actually transforms to something else. And since we discovered post-perovskite transition in silicates, people work diligently to look for this similar type of post-perovskite transition in other materials. And indeed, we find that the some very unrelated to geophysics material have shown the post-perovskite transition, for example, Fe2O3, hematite. We studied this hematite at high pressure. As well known, hematite is antiferromagnetic, or Fe2O3 is antiferromagnetic at ambient pressure, a canted antiferromagnetic. So we find this is nuclear forward scattering measurements as a function of pressure, and low pressure structure or alumina structure or hematite structure is stable up to 55 GPa, and this is a time spectra. Just to show you just very simple way to analyze this, look at this data, is that we basically measure the number of different energy levels in ion nuclei, and that gives you hills and valleys in the time spectra. More hills and valleys you have, that means you have more different states in ion nuclei, meaning that if you have spin ordering, you would have more wiggles and more hills and valleys, whereas if you have no spin ordering, you would have very simple spectra like this. So as shown by previous studies, we confirmed that this hematite transforms to an orthorhombic phase, which doesn't have magnetic ordering. You see very simple spectrum. Then we measure we synthesize post-perovskite. It transforms to post-perovskite at higher pressure. And then we measure the nuclear force scattering. And surprisingly enough, we see hills and valleys, which is a little less than the hematite, but still you can see decent number. And that means that, you know, Fe2O3 undergoes very funny sequence of transition from antiferromagnetic to either diamagnetic or paramagnetic to either antiferromagnetic or ferromagnetic. We don't know yet whether this is ferromagnetic phase or antiferromagnetic phase, but this is something under investigation right now. If you look at the post-perovskite structure, it has very interesting structure. It's two-dimensional. Again, there are two different cation sites, one eight-fold coordinated and six-fold coordinated. And if you look at eight-fold coordinated sites, unlike perovskite, the distance between cation is very small, the interatomic distance between these two cation is very small, and they actually share phase, not the corners. That means that they have less shielding from oxygen atoms, and they have more chance of having direct interaction between cation and cation. We still don't know whether that magnetic ordering I show you is because of the strong direct interaction between cation and cation, or some sort of super exchange, that means through oxygen atoms. But from the structure, you know, it's very intriguing to see the potential possibility of having direct cation and cation interaction. And in summary, likely that this post-perovskite transition is indeed relevant to the Earth's interior, and there are some seismic and laboratory evidence we have. And this post-perovskite transition seems to explain some intriguing seismic features people have observed over last many decades. And finally, I'd like to thank my collaborators, my students at MIT, postdocs, and I also like to thank my collaborators at synchrotron facilities who make all these measurements possible. Thank you. I'm sorry about not providing the detailed explanation on this diagram. Here, both yellow and reds are oxygen atoms. The reason I distinguish here is that red oxygen atoms are the ones that is corner sharing oxygens, and the yellow ones are edge sharing oxygens. So I just want to highlight or distinguish two different oxygens. Whereas in perovskite, all the oxygens are corner shared.
Are you able to comment on whether there are inferred changes in viscosity that go into
space change and what the order of magnitude might be? We don't know yet. Yeah. And one thing I know from colleague theoreticians, they also have a hard time to compute the viscosity, although it is one of the most important parameters.
Yeah. I think it seems that post-perovskite transition wouldn't occur much higher than 300 to 400 kilometers above sea level. So it can't possibly explain the anticorrelation, because that anticorrelation, due to the statistics of the seismology, extends at least 1,000 kilometers.
Right.
Supporting the anticorrelation.
Right. Yeah. Thank you so much for pointing that out. Yes, this is the weakness of this explanation, and actually I was thinking about it, and I discovered one paper published in a couple of weeks ago in EPSL. They were discussing about these issues, whether the post-perovskite transition should occur below 300 kilometer, yet anti-correlation exists from much higher elevation from the Coleman boundary, and yet seismologists yet to provide precise, nature of this anti-correlation as a function of depth. It's all beamed tomography. So you don't exactly know, which signal is from, that's too much exaggeration. But the point in the paper is that one hypothesis you can bring up is that maybe there exists two different anti-correlation. One explained by post-perovskite, the other explained by something else in the mid-mantle. But the other question. Right. Yes. Yes. But the effect of iron is a good candidate. But yes, there is enough reason to believe that iron can cause anti-correlation or anti-correlation between bulk sound velocity and shear wave velocity, but yet we haven't had experimental results that shows iron indeed, make the bulk sound velocity lower. Theoretically, and from other analog materials, you can infer to that, and it's highly likely that iron will make it. But, we want to see actual data. And it's kind of backward argument, because if you step back and just look at the laboratory experiment, combining large Clapeyron slope and the physical property of post-perovskite, it is likely that there exists lateral change in phase at the bottom of the mantle. If that is the case, then there should be anti-correlation. Right, if you have lateral variation in mineralogy, then perovskite, post-perovskite should give rise anti-correlation. So it's kind of backward thinking, and I think, yes, you're right that it's too much of extension to explain all anti-correlation observed in the mantle explained by the post-perovskite transition. Yeah. So first principles, it's a calculation, but we have some experimental results that support that magnitude of the slope. Yes. Right. It's a polycrystalline material. And the way you determine the phase boundary is to use X-ray diffraction. X-ray diffraction pattern of perovskite and post-perovskite is very different. So you can... you get amorphous space at ambient temperature, at high pressure, because you pressurize the starting material under very high pressure with a lot of deviatoric stress. And at high temperature, deviatoric stress decreases because, you know, you thermally relieve the deviatoric stress. So in terms of experimental condition, high temperature is much better. So in X-ray diffraction experiments, you normally distinguish, you know, you normally use formation and disappearance, no, appearance and disappearance of the diffraction lines of post perovskite and perovskite. But it's very difficult to determine because it appears that the phase transformation is really sluggish. So people have hard time to transform completely post-perovskite into post-perovskite. Oftentimes you see mixtures, and there are only few literature existing right now, few paper existing right now which reports complete transformation. So that's another thing that we have to look for. And extension of that is that mantle is multi-component system. I've been showing very simple system, rather monomineralic or monophase system. But you have iron binary system, aluminum ternary system. System gets, you know, more complex as you include more, or if you get more realistic about mantle. And then, you know, this boundary would become this boundary would have some sort of, you know, broadening where you have two-phase or multiple two-phase, both perovskite and perovskite exist coexisting together before getting to the regime of post-perovskite. So those are the issues that we need to address. But this, we believe, captures, you know, first order properties of post-perovskite.
What kind of density could you expect through this transition?
About 2%, which is experimentally constrained.
And then that should be seen in the gravity field of the Earth.
I'm sorry?
Can that be seen in the gravity field of the Earth?
Well, I don't know. This post-perovskite layer is very thin. You're talking about 3,000 kilometer mantle, and this post-perovskite layer may have like 200 kilometers. I don't know. I'm not, you know, expert on that. But, you know, 2% density increase and 200 kilometer thickness compared to 3,000 kilometer, and it's 3,000 kilometer away from the surface as well. Okay. Okay. And also you have to take into account that it is likely that this would have lateral variation as well. It's not, you know, just constant thickness layer. It's varying.
So you must have lateral variation to see a
Okay.
I'm surprised that you didn't show a photograph of your equipment. You know, I realize that your pressure chamber is very small.
I'm sorry that I don't have slides for the diamonds. I wonder if I have here.
On your website,
yes, you can always come to my website. But just give you a brief introduction about this device. Diamond cell is about, you know, 2 to 3 centimeter tall and 5 centimeter. In diameter, that's it. We use regular screws to bring the diamond anvils together. That's all you need. So it's very compact. portable, so you can bring this cell to anywhere you go for measurements. Yeah.
How about the exhibiting equipment?
I'm sorry?
How much measuring equipment do you have?
That's all. You don't need synchrotron, for example. Yeah. Well, if you just want to see the sample, which is still valid, there are many things you can observe using your eyes under microscope, but if you need to use synchrotron, for example, you know,
it's not the table.
Yeah, it's not the table. Yeah, right. You need large facility.